I'll call the case. It's case number 2013-CA-2037, Thompson and Rogers versus United Securities Alliance and concerning Catlin Insurance Company. And I'll ask counsel the same as the last case. I assume you have received a copy of our written procedures concerning oral argument, and I'd ask if either of you have any questions about those.
We received it, but we have no questions.
Right? Okay, thank you. With that, we will start with the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm John R. Mann of Gordon Rees, registration number 16088, here on behalf of the garnishee appellant, Catlin Insurance Company. This is an appeal following remand from a prior appeal in this case, where this court held that the trial court committed clear error in determining that Catlin had incurred no reasonable defense costs in the defense of two underlying arbitrations that could be set off against its policy limits pursuant to the terms of its policy. And so the central issue in this appeal is whether the trial court properly complied with this court's mandate from the prior appeal to determine the amount of Catlin's reasonable defense costs in the two underlying arbitrations as an offset against Catlin's policy limits. Catlin's challenge in this appeal is to how the trial court arrived at its determination. So for argument today, I'm going to discuss the trial court's ruling on reasonable defense costs as though it were the product of an independent review of the evidence without any reliance on the law of the case doctrine. While Catlin believes that the trial court erred in invoking the law of the case doctrine to rely on its findings from dictum in a footnote in its order that was reversed, we also believe the court made sufficient findings that its decision can be considered the result of an independent review of the evidence. Because this court must address whether there is an adequate basis in the record for the trial court's independent review, my argument today will focus on whether the court's findings are supported by the record, along with a critique of its methodology. Now, this court's prior opinion remanded for a determination of Catlin's reasonable defense costs. Our position is that upon remand, and this is very clear when you look at the prior opinion, the prior opinion said, look, the trial court in its order that was reversed in the prior appeal, said that, well, I can't look at the billing statements that were submitted. I can't rely on those because they were redacted. And this court said that's no barrier to determining whether the fee was reasonable. As the court said, the redacted invoices amply demonstrate the expenses were actually incurred. And it said central entries were not redacted at all, and others, although redacted, have sufficient information to support the inference that the expenses were necessary. The other part of the court's opinion was that the trial judge completely disregarded the testimony of the attorney who defended the underlying arbitrations that her fees were reasonable, saying, well, of course the attorney's going to say their fees are reasonable. Well, in this prior appeal, its prior opinion, this court said that, well, that testimony cannot be wholly disregarded on the ground she was a lawyer of some of the invoices. An attorney is qualified to testify about the reasonableness of his or her own fees. And so by those findings or that holding in the prior appeal, this court, I think, made pretty clear that the trial court on remand was to consider the invoices as evidence of reasonable fees or the amount of fees or amount of defense costs incurred. And it was to consider the testimony of the attorney who defense attorney who incurred those costs, that those fees and the total amount was reasonable.
Mr. Mann, let me ask you a question about the consideration of the invoices on remand. I believe I saw in the October 10th, the original order, the court made some remark about half of the entries were legible or couldn't be redacted, couldn't be relied upon. And so in the second order, the order on remand, when the court referred back to the first order, it basically perhaps adopted that about half of the invoice could be accepted, and the amount that was awarded ultimately was about half the invoice. And so even it wasn't particularly artful, isn't that some basis for supporting the court's discretion in the amount of the award?
Well, no, because The testimony was that all of the invoices were actually paid. And really, and this brings up a point that we've actually argued since the last appeal, which is the trial judge does not have to do a line-by-line analysis of an entire billing records to determine if the fee is reasonable. I mean, is it really important to know who the defense lawyer talked to, who they interviewed? Matters that were redacted by the attorney herself as work product. I want to emphasize that Catlin did not redact these invoices. That was done by the attorney who produced them on the grounds that she did not have her client's consent to disclose that work product. So Catlin is faced with these invoices, which the defense attorney they hired has redacted herself. They had nothing to do with that. They paid those bills. And if you, the way, you don't have to look at every item, every line by line item to determine if that amount was reasonable. What you do, and this is what we've already used in following the Seventh Circuit line of cases, is that you look at the entire amount that was expended, you look at the context of the work that was done, and you look at whether it was actually paid, and then and if that seems to be reasonable under the circumstances, there's no need for a court to engage in a time-consuming line-by-line item review. Now the question is, well, isn't it interesting that if you cut out all the redactions, you end up kind of where the trial court did? It may be, but first of all, the trial court didn't rely on that, and there's no guarantee that that actually comes out to a reasonable amount. It's just manipulating numbers.
Okay, let me just ask you this question out of curiosity. If we remand for the court to make more thorough analysis or findings, is it possible that the court could award less than the amount awarded at present?
That's always a possibility. But we think that if the court gives explicit directions on remand to apply the Lodestar method the way virtually every decision addressing the how courts determine attorney fees or reasonable expenses has held, that the court should just look at these billing invoices and say, okay, this amount was expended, it was actually paid. There doesn't seem to be any indication because, and again, as it was noted in the present, as in the prior opinion, the garnishors here presented no evidence contesting the reasonableness of the expenses shown by the invoices. So it was essentially undisputed. The testimony of the attorney who incurred the cost was undisputed that they're reasonable. So we have essentially undisputed testimony that these were the costs that were incurred, they were paid, and they were reasonable. And still we have the trial court plucking a number from unrelated testimony to say, well, I think that's a reasonable amount.
Mr. Mann, let me follow up. What you stated earlier is relying on some federal authority. You can look at the context of the work done. So if a court cannot discern what the context of the work is done because of redactions, do you quarrel with a conclusion that those fees can be deemed to be unreasonable?
Well, I don't think you can say they're unreasonable. I don't think you can say they're unreasonable. I think the most you could say is we haven't seen anything to support that they are reasonable. But the redaction issue was specifically dealt with by the Seventh Circuit and the Metavante case, Metavante versus Emigrant Savings Bank, 619 F3rd 748. And that was at page 773, which was cited in all of our briefs. There, the person who was being required to pay fees argued that, well, you can't use unredacted bills. Unredacted bills are required in order to allow the district court to review the fee request for reasonableness. And the Seventh Circuit rejected that and saying, no, if the attorneys submit bills and the client pays them, we're going to presume that those are reasonable. That clients aren't, especially insurance companies, aren't in the business of paying unsupported or unreasonable fees. And for that reason, there isn't a need to review the redacted materials to determine whether it was done. We have the circumstantial guarantee of reasonableness that they were in fact paid by an insurance company. They were actually paid. And the insurance company, there was no evidence the insurance company cut any of that time as unreasonable. At least it didn't come out at the hearing. So there isn't, and I think this is the kind of ruling that would benefit trial courts in general by saying, no, you don't have to go through every item and find and see if it's reasonable. Now, if The opposing, the adversary wants to go through and point out items that are unreasonable. They can do that, but they didn't do that here. Well, I think they had a couple of items they had questions about, but they didn't have somebody come in and say, well, this shouldn't have been charged, this shouldn't have been charged, or in my opinion, the amount of reasonable defense cost was X amount of dollars. They didn't have anybody do that. And in fact, the attorney whose testimony the trial judge relied on showed that there was absolutely no foundation for extrapolating the amount he claimed as a for prosecuting the one arbitration to a reasonable defense cost for both arbitrations. There was very detailed testimony by the attorney who defended the underlying arbitrations in both cases that these were difficult cases to defend because the principals of the company were gone. The company, the documents were missing. They had to locate everyone who had any knowledge, and in one case, they couldn't talk to the president of the defendant because he was suing the defendant in an employment case. So there's ample, and in fact, these findings were made in Catlin's original proposed findings of fact that were submitted following the July 2010 hearing. All the findings and reasonableness that were necessary to support an award and the application of the Lodestar method were shown in those proposed findings. I think that if you were to say, is what the trial court did here arbitrary and capricious, I think you would have to say yes. I mean, I think taking one number that was testified to by counsel and trying to shove that square peg into the round hole of the defense costs without any foundation to show that the costs or the expenses are the same, that the tasks are similar, or that even that the other side actually had some familiarity with the expense of defending an arbitration is just picking a number that has no reasonable basis in the record or no rational relation to anything, any of the evidence, especially the Catlin presented. So Catlin has already paid the amounts under the writ of garnishment that it does not dispute it's owed. The only issue is, can it be made to pay more than it contracted with its insured to pay under the policy? Because if the trial court's ruling is upheld, it will be paying out well in excess of what it was contractually obligated with its insured to pay. And for that reason, I hate to do this, but we have to ask this court once again to remand this case to the trial court, with specific directions on how to calculate a reasonable defense cost on remand. And with that, I ask that the judgment be reversed and remanded with those explicit directions. I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. You have just over 3 minutes.
May it please the court, Chris Mosley from the law firm of Sherman and Howard, bar number 24440 for appellees Mark Thompson and Rosalind Rogers. This case has been hotly disputed from long before Mr. Mann and I got involved in this case. And there is one thing that we finally agree on, and that's what the mandate was from the prior panel from its decision in February 2012. And that was that the Court of Appeals asked the district court to go back and review the evidence once more. And based on a review of that evidence in its role as prior of fact, with all the tools that a prior of fact typically is given, to make a determination of the reasonable fees that should be deducted from the policy's limit. That was the extent of the mandate. And so the question here becomes, did Judge Martinez on remand follow that mandate? And we would submit to the court that the record reflects the answer is yes. Judge Martinez, in his order, took a look at each piece of evidence that was submitted, the redacted invoices, did not look at the dropped phone. These are the redacted invoices. There's an enormous amount of blackmail, but he took a look at him again. He took a look at Ms. Height's testimony. The Court of Appeals of the first panel said in the opinion that it was improper for Judge Martinez to wholly disregard Ms. Hite's testimony. So he came back and he took a look at it. Now, he made his determination as prior fact that that evidence, while, as he put it, minimally sufficient to meet the requirements, still was not persuasive. He's got that right as prior fact to make that determination. And then he looked at Mr. Cortade's testimony about the attorney's fees issue in the arbitration. And based upon the case law in the 10th Circuit that we've cited in our brief, the Robinson case, the Shaw case, as well as the Flying J case of the District of Utah, which allows a trial court to at least consider the positions of the parties on attorney's fees as an element of evidence in making an attorney's fees decision, Judge Martinez put all of that together and made the determination that the right amount of attorney's fees to deduct based on his review of the evidence was $320,000.
Well, Mr. Mosley, let me ask you a question then. So given that the mandate was for the court to determine reasonableness of fees, did the court start at a lodestar amount, and was the court required to do so?
So the answer is whether the court started with the lodestar amount, we don't know. He doesn't use the word lodestar in his opinion. He does reference the fact that he re-reviewed the invoices and still found them to be difficult. But I think the question you ask hits on the real issue here, and is the issue that is of greater importance, I think, to the trial courts here in Colorado, and that is, was he required to do so? And we would submit to the court that the answer to that is no. And the answer to that is no, supported by the case law in Colorado. Specifically, the Colorado Supreme Court in the American Water Development case, which actually is cited by Catlin, refers to the Hensley case from the United States Supreme Court. That Hensley case has been cited by lots and lots of cases. I know it was cited in the Payan case, in which Judge Burris, you were a dissenting judge. And in that case, the Supreme Court said there is no precise rule or formula for attorney's fees. So that's where we start. We start from the presumption that a district court, or if the jury happens to be a trier of fact in the situation, has the ability to use whatever methodology makes sense. Now, having said that, there is an abundance of case law in Colorado which says that the lodestar method is the preferred method to be used, and it makes a lot of sense. Most of the lawyers that do work today in 2014 do their work on an hourly basis. Even many plaintiffs' lawyers doing contingency work at least keep track of their hours in order to present an attorney's fees application. But although it's a preferred method, it's not the required method, and it's based on the preference of using it. It's based on the assumption that the trier of fact, district court, or jury is going to have adequate documentation from which to make the reasonableness determination. And we've got that from the Payan case, the Spensieri case, and even the Robinson case in the 10th Circuit. Each of those courts noted that there had to be some semblance of reliability on the documentation that courts are going to use to make the lodestar determination. So the Payan case says, the party seeking an award of fees should submit evidence supporting hours worked and rates claimed. Where the documentation of hours is inadequate, the district court may reduce the award accordingly. To that end, applicants should maintain billing time records in a manner that will enable a reviewing court to identify distinct claims. That's not this. That is most cases. Most cases don't have the amount of redactions that showed up in this case.
Yeah. Mr. Mosley, whether or not the court's required to use the lodestar method, it's the reasoning behind the award still can't be arbitrary. And so in this case, if we accept that the court basically eliminated the invoices because they were heavily redacted and also heavily discounted or eliminated the attorney's testimony and basically relied only on the amount that was paid for by Mr. Cortade, would that rise to the level of arbitrariness in that the role of a petitioner and a defendant in a matter might have different implications as far as billing, just to say, well, this is what this side got, so this is what this other side is getting?
No, that would not raise to, it certainly wouldn't be an improper way to, in fact, that issue, this is what concerned Judge Martinez when he first took a look at the evidence. He actually found that the evidence that Catlin submitted just wasn't supportive. And so what was left was Mr. Cortade's testimony. And as prior fact, he has the right to put whatever weight he wants on it. And at that point, his determination was, that's about the only evidence I have. And ultimately, on remand, he went and took a look at that, and he had the right to consider it under the Robinson case and under the Shaw case. He could consider it. Now, he could have rejected it out altogether if he wanted to. He has the right, as prior fact being there, to put whatever weight he wants to put on that evidence. And that's what he found in his role reviewing this case as the persuasive evidence once the prior Court of Appeals panel told him he had to come up with something. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Thanks.
And we would submit, we've got the case law that supports the concept, and it's the Spensieri case, it's also the Robinson case that consistently say that you've got to have good documents. And then there's the Premier Pool case and the Randolph case, where the courts there said it's appropriate for a district court to disregard redactions. We would submit in making the attorney's fees determination, we would submit in this case, given the high level of redactions, that there are 50% or more of the entries redacted, that it's appropriate in that circumstance for a court not to use the quote preferred method of the lodestar calculation, because the fundamental premise of that no longer exists.
Well, is it considered a form of lodestar if the court accepts basically as the base figure what the attorneys are asking for and then discounts that fee for whatever the court feels in its discretion is appropriate? Is that basically a form of the lodestar or no?
I'm sorry, could you?
Okay, when we're talking about the lodestar, is it sort of an acceptable way to use the lodestar method to accept as the baseline what the attorneys are asking for as far as the fee award, and then to decide if that's reasonable or to discount it for whatever miscellaneous reasons that the court in its discretion feels is appropriate?
I think, Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, it's appropriate for the court to do either. If the court in its discretion took a look at the invoices and decided, well, I've taken a look at all the invoices, half of them are redacted, I've heard arguments of counsel on both sides, but based on all the evidence that I've seen, whether it's the limited evidence in this record or if it's an expert witness has come in to testify or there's other evidence to support that, and at that point in time, the district court decides that I've weighed all the evidence and I've determined that, yeah, I can't read all those invoices, but I think the bottom line number is appropriate and makes sense. Certainly, the district court has that discretion, just as the district court has the discretion to take out the redacted amounts and make that determination, or in the unique circumstances of this case, given the heavy amount of redactions, not using the lodestar method at all. I think a district court, or if it happens to be a jury in the appropriate circumstance, has all those tools available to it. And as long as its decision is supported by the evidence in the record, then it is well within its discretion to make its determination. And we said, but that's what Judge Martinez did here. There was no abuse of discretion.
Mr. Mosley, would you agree that we don't know exactly how the court came to that figure?
Your Honor, I think Judge Martinez said in his order that, well, let me back up. Is it crystal clear? I don't think it's crystal clear. Is it reasonably clear? I do think it's reasonably clear. He did go through in page 3 of his order and indicate that when he went back and looked at the invoices, they remain as heavily redacted and indiscernible as they were the first time he reviewed them. And he did go back and take a look at Ms. Height's testimony and found it minimally acceptable but not persuasive. And then he went back and said, using Ms. Height's testimony and Mr. Cortate's testimony, he came to the conclusion that the $320,000 number would be acceptable, splitting it 160 per case, fundamentally based upon the testimony of Mr. Cortate.
All right, well, let me ask you about that testimony about Mr. Cortate. That dealt with the Thompson-Rogers arbitration and not Branch Avenue. So was it appropriate for the court to consider plaintiff costs in one arbitration in figuring out another arbitration costs?
I think so in this case. Again, I think Judge Martinez, as he indicated in his first decision, thought that there wasn't sufficient evidence presented by Catlin, who had the burden of proof, to support any amount to be reduced. When this court asked Judge Martinez to come up with something, then Judge Martinez did take a look at the Cortate testimony. The testimony down below indicated that the Branch Avenue and the Rogers-Thompson arbitration were very similar. In fact, Catlin argued that the two should be joined together as interrelated acts. They actually came about from the same investment in a warehouse in Indiana. So the two cases were very close to one another, and so in that circumstance, I think there is a reasonable basis for Judge Martinez to make that determination, and he didn't have a whole lot more to go on. And I apologize, I don't recall whether it was you, Judge Lichtenstein, or you, Judge Burris, but one of you had mentioned when Mr. Mann was up here arguing his case that there is evidence in the record to show that the unredacted entries, when you add them up, come pretty close to that $320,000 number. It's $325,000 and change based upon an affidavit that my paralegal, Jamie Mulholland, put together. When you take a look at that evidence, you take a look at the fact that the Rogers-Thompson and the Branch Avenue arbitrations were very similar. They were interrelated acts, all the rest of that stuff. I think there's enough to support what Judge Martinez did. And to that point, the invoices themselves and the affidavit of Ms. Mulholland shows that there is evidence in the record to provide an alternative basis to support Judge Martinez's decision. Your Honors, with the 2 minutes that I have, a couple of quick points. First, the Taco Bell Medavante approach that the Seventh Circuit takes. I know that it was Judge Posner that did the Taco Bell case. We would submit to the court that there's no Colorado case law to support that approach, and there's a lot of reasons not to support that approach. To the extent Catlin takes the position that the Taco Bell Medavante approach should be a presumption, it certainly, there's no basis for that, and it certainly can't serve as an absolute presumption. It's got to be a rebuttable presumption at best. Otherwise, what we're doing is we're taking away from every district court in the court in the state of Colorado, as well as every jury that has to make this determination, its fundamental right to be trier of fact, to weigh the evidence, to weigh the credibility of the witnesses, to determine whether redacted invoices are good enough or not. There's no good public policy reason here in Colorado to adopt that. And in this case, there's certainly no reason to adopt it, because the presumption under Taco Bell can't be rebutted unless you have good evidence. And again, that's the issue we have here. But we would submit to the court that there's really no reason even to address that issue, given the other reasons to affirm the district court's opinion. But it's a novel argument, and it's one fraught with peril in many respects, as articulated in our briefs. And finally, Your Honor, the last 37 seconds that I have here, we'd request that the court affirm the district court's opinion. We'd also request an award of attorney's fees. We have our reasons in our brief, but we'd also ask the court to exercise its discretion under Rule 39.5. This case started out as a securities case in a Texas arbitration under various blue sky laws. Those laws provided for the attorney's fees so that an award of attorney's fees so that the claimants could be made whole. That case then graduated to the district court in the garnishment proceeding, and in his discretion, Judge Martinez issued an award of attorney's fees on the same ground to be consistent with the purpose of the attorney's fee award in the blue sky laws. We would submit to the court that should the court affirm the judgment here, the same rationale should apply, and in the court's discretion, we'd ask that the court award the claimants their attorney's fees in this appeal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mosley.
The federal cases that Mr. Mosley cites, Shaw and Robinson, what those cases say is that the court can look at the opposing counsel's attorney fees to determine if the fees being claimed were necessary, because you look at what the opposing counsel did to force the party claiming fees to incur so many fees. And I think, as the federal courts say, opposing counsel fees are not an immutable yardstick of reasonableness for determining the prevailing party's fees. Here, the trial judge did not even attempt to use the lodestar amount. He didn't do what Mr. Mosley's paralegal does, which take the full amount, then eliminate all the redacted entries. He didn't do that. He just said, I'm starting with what Mr. Courtrade said was his reasonable fee for the arbitration, and I'm going to double it. No attempt to use the Lodestar at all. And as for the contention that the Lodestar method is not required, the case law from the state would appear to differ. It's the case repeatedly say a court determining reasonable attorney fees should start with the Lodestar, or a court reasonable attorney fees is to be determined using the Lodestar method. That appears, sounds to me like it's language of direction, language what is required, rather than, well, the judge can just come up with anything he wants to determine what's the reasonable attorney fees. I think that by using the Lodestar method, you avoid any contention that the methodology was somehow arbitrary or unfair. The invoices here show the hours were worked and the rates were charged, and the testimony shows that the invoices were paid. There should not be any contention that merely because entries are redacted, the court cannot determine that those fees were reasonable, that they were paid by an insurance company without hope of indemnification by any third party, I think strongly indicates that the fees were reasonable. Now, as for the Branch Avenue arbitration, whether it was arbitrary for the trial court to use Mr. Courtrade's fees for prosecuting the Thompson Rogers arbitration as the amount of fees for the defense of the Branch Avenue arbitration, I would direct the court to Brenda Heights' testimony at pages 195 through 198 of the hearing transcript, where she describes how much more difficult the Branch Avenue arbitration was than the Thompson Rogers arbitration and all the work that was necessary and the import of that case. I think that tends to establish that the trial court's just using an arbitrary number was in fact that. Now, as for whether adopting the Seventh Circuit rule would create a presumption of reasonableness, I would point out that the case on the Lodestar method already say that the Lodestar method creates a presumed reasonable fee. The amount of hours worked by the rate charge, that creates a presumption of reasonable fee. We already have that presumption. Sure, it's a rebuttable presumption, but it already exists in Colorado and law, and adopting the Seventh Circuit would not change that. I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you very much to both counsel. We appreciate your arguments. This case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.